1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Hey, welcome back. Just in case you were wondering how long the break has been since season 2 ended, yeah, it was 75 weeks ago. According to this website, that calculates to 17 months, 528 days, 12,660 hours. Well, if you really want to break it down, 759,613 minutes. So yeah, kind of walked out one door and just didn't come back in another, you know, a long break. Anyhow, if anyone is still out there who used to listen to this podcast, I'm inviting you back in. Please, if you'd like to join again, season 3 is going to start up. You could say this is a preamble to season 3. This could be the first episode of season 3. You know, at this point, when you're away from the game, what was that again? 75 weeks? Do these numbers really matter? But yeah, I felt the urge. I felt the longing to return to some kind of podcast. There have been, if I could even begin to talk or create a sentence, there have been several ideas in the back of my head to come back in a slightly different way. You know, when I first started the podcast, a lot of it had to do with one of my pals at work, one of my coworkers, Max, and I kept getting questions about how do you start a podcast at our job. And we both kind of looked into it. We both started making a podcast. He created one all about people who absolutely love going down to Disney World. I started one about people who are crazy about still shooting film and old-fashioned vintage cameras and what's going on down here in South Jersey regarding photography. And this was back in 2019 when the podcast started. I kind of kept it going for a while, opening it up, of course, to anybody who wanted to call in, anybody who wanted to reach out over stuff like Skype or FaceTime. This was pre-Zoom. This is pre-pandemic. And then, sure enough, the pandemic, of course, hit. And the photography thing really blew up on YouTube. You know, it's just really amazing. There had, of course, been several people talking about film photography and passionate about film photography. That never really went away during the years I was also drawn back into it. But particularly between 2019, 2020, and the first year of the pandemic, it really blew up. So I kind of bailed on my own photography podcast just when it was getting hot and trendy. So I always got a great sense of timing. I who knows? I could have perhaps kept that mysterious listener who kept popping up from, what was it, Norway? But yeah, I'm sure that whoever that person or persons were, I don't know, you know, I'm going to find out if there is still somebody listening to the show, in Scandinavia, or I believe it was particularly Norway. Maybe they're still around. Anyhow, I'm going to keep calling it, bringing it all back home. I think it's still going to go back to photography, episodes, you could say, you know, things going on with cameras, film, developing, doing shoots, thinking about stuff going on regarding that kind of world, you know, which I, you know, for lack of a better word, would call analog, though some people don't really like that word anymore. And looking back, though, over season 1 and season 2, there were some really, really fun phone calls, you know, interviews. I think the term I was using was, you know, live chats, you know, kind of like, so basically people doing projects who wanted to get on board the podcast and talk about it. Whether it was my old pal John Leach releasing some new music, Mark Gallo releasing a new, not just music, but a video project along with the music, you know, people working on photography or recounting their amazing years in photography. And of course, people who are writing books, you know, my friend and yours, Ribs, you know, Wayne Reed. And, you know, I think what I really wanted to get back into as well was things related around books, you know, and in a past life, I really got into that. You know, there was a period where I myself got into trying to make longer and longer projects out of autobiographical fiction. So yeah, I think that was sort of my idea, was like, maybe I'm going to just switch gears a little bit, come back and just do a podcast all about autobiographical fiction, and maybe intersperse that with not just my stuff, but reading from other things, you know, kind of like looking over at my bookshelf and reading aloud on the podcast some favorite passages from authors that still rock my world, or of course bringing people on the podcast who want to talk about where they are right now with their work, with their writing. So yeah, that was an area I thought never really quite got the same focus as photography did, but yeah, I think where I am now with season 3 is, I think it's one huge umbrella, you know. It's kind of like bringing it all back home could mean anything really that you're working on, whether you're also someone living in South Jersey, you know, the southern part of New Jersey here, or you're someone living in Scandinavia. You know, I keep going back to Norway. But seriously, yeah, if you want to share over the you know, the internet here, whether it's Zoom or Skype or FaceTime, some way we can just extract the audio and do some podcasting together, that would be great. So yeah, I you know, it's funny. I think, well, it's not really that funny, but you know, there was that revival of the classic HBO show from the 90s, you know, Sex and the City. And I didn't really catch that many episodes, but I did catch the episode where Carrie, I guess the main character, is invited on a podcast, and she just kind of looks up and goes like, no way, no, please, you know, enough with the podcast. And it's funny because, like, just when she said that, I don't know, some part of me thought like, yeah, are we reaching podcasting exhaustion? You know, and again, this was in that stage where people weren't really quite coming back to work, you know. But yeah, I kind of feel like, you know, if things would just turn a corner, I felt like I could have such a better positive attitude about returning to all kinds of projects. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I think I personally came out of pandemic part 1, 2, and 3 a little bit worse for the wear. You know, I feel like I've kind of have this mentality, this still have this sort of bunker mentality, like get back from work and just kind of hide, you know? And yeah, I think the New Year's approaching, and I think it's time to let go of that a little bit, try to open things up. And who knows, maybe 2023 is going to be the spring where we can look back at least one winter season and go, okay, yeah, we are actually turning a corner. We're not just revisiting, you know, COVID winter part 4 or whatever it is, you know. So yeah, was hoping for a little bit of sunshine when it came to that stuff back in 2021. It didn't happen. And then, yeah, I got kind of sidetracked with some personal stuff relating to yeah, where my head was at, and some family health issues, that kind of stuff. So anyway, I'm looking forward to reaching out again to you guys. I'm going to continue with, again, where this podcast is going, bringing it all back home concerning photography. I definitely have some stuff to talk about there, and concerning hopefully literature. So who knows? Maybe this season three preamble should start with a little bit of that. So I'm going to take a breather and come back with something. This is an excerpt from a novel called Mile End, which I've been trying to rewrite ever so slightly to essentially get rid of any fabric of fiction and just try to restore the true autobiographical fiction part of it. In other words, the names are real now, and the person who's narrating it is me. Anyway, this is a short little excerpt. It takes place in the summer of 1995, overseas, the Middle East, and this first section, this first little bit, is waking up one morning in a youth hostel, a place called Gordon's. So here we go, first take. Blinding lemon light fills my cubicle at Gordon's. I'm propelled awake, bristled by the sound of two Australians arguing over a towel. It's an outrage, clearly, this wet, sandy towel at their feet. But who was to blame? The redhead who defends herself with a wine, an Aussie wine, or her boyfriend who insists that he wasn't the one who left it on the ground. I lift myself up on my elbows, survey the room. It's a blinding furnace of light that primes every object. The two Australians continue to stare at their crumpled wet towel as if it were a maimed wombat. I've only just awoken, yet I'm lacquered with sweat. It's not the most profound of realizations, but still, you can't get around it. It's engaging, the heat, this Israeli summer sun. I glance at my watch. It's only 8 in the morning, and already it's way too hot. I'm fascinated by the incredulous obviousness of it all, stunned by the far-reaching stupidity of my response. Israel, late June. I mean, I'm amazed by the heat. Can it get any more dense? So I find my way to the showers, forgetting to bring my soap, let alone my towel. Maybe I'll try this again, one more time. I retrace my steps, rummage through my backpack, try it again. Stalls are empty, hang my cutoffs and t-shirt and dry towel on a hook, then crank on the water. A tepid, almost foul-smelling but cold dribble starts to spurt on me. I try another nozzle, more of the same. There's nowhere to put your soap except the cement floor, which is faintly viscous with scum and hairballs. A shower like this, it presents a challenge. Like, where do you put your soap? I shift it back and forth, left hand, right hand, but it doesn't quite end there. There's no place to put it outside the stalls either. I dry myself off one-handed, then wrap the bar of soap in the towel, which is in turn wrapped and folded under my arm. I'm almost there. I've got my cutoffs buttoned. I've got my shirt on. And just as I turn to leave, yes, the towel slips from my hold. The bar of soap runs from the towel, and both succeed in absorbing the flocculent refuse of the floor. Maybe next time. But lousy shower or not, I'm feeling better. Brace slightly cooled off. I set about refastening my backpack, stowing the injured soap and towel in a plastic bag, attempting to summon all the necessary stamina and sauciance of my journey upriver, my bus ride all the way up to the hills of Lebanon, this border town called Kiryat Shemona. So much depends on how you start your day, doesn't it? The right breakfast under your belt, the proper allotment of coffee and maybe cigarettes, an adequate amount of time giving over to your digestion, your morning mail, perhaps the financial page. I pick up my passport and traveler's checks from the front desk, manned this morning by a devastatingly hungover Brit with a silver nose ring and a Bob Marley t-shirt. His puffy eyes are glazed with 100 years of disastrous sleep, but he's surprisingly helpful, points out to me a useful map on the far wall where I'll pick up directions to the bus terminal. It's a day for bus connections, for bus strategy. It's also simple. Just connect A, bus outside of Gordon's, to B, Tel Aviv bus terminal, then to C, the city of Kiryat Shemona, disembark there, get to D, the place I'll be spending this summer, Kibbutz Dafna, connect, graft, regulate it, consult your timetable, your Xerox of instructions, keep an eye on doctor's warnings, carry with you at all times your backpack, your compass, your Swiss Army knife, observe the local customs, pray to Allah five times a day, never let a Hasidic sell you a falafel, and above all, always wear a hat. I don my sunglasses and hoist my backpack on my shoulders. It's time to embark on my pilgrimage. Holy Land awaits just outside this youth hostel door. Backward and forward and backward empire of prophets and patriarchs, crucifixions and cupolas, ululations and oozies. Take me to your bus connections and bloody highways. Take me before I change my fucking mind. I step out onto the blistering sidewalk, cross the street to my first destination, my first wait. I smoke my cigarettes. I crane my neck. I dawdle and sweat. The numbered bus I'm looking for, well, it shows up, finally. I climb aboard, backpack in tow, lockstep with the gospel of it all. Okay, I think I'm going to pause there. This is Charles again. That felt unusual, reading something aloud. Some of the backstory on that that part of the book. It really did take place that summer of 1995. I really was leaving a youth hostel to head up all the way north to a place I'd never been to before, and all the things that come to mind for us folks who have straddled both sides of the technology fence, you know, people who were born in the 60s or 70s, you know, we remember the days when traveling just consisted of Xeroxes and maps, you know, and hastily scribbled directions, and once you get here, you're going to go there, and keep an eye on that, and don't miss that, and if you do, start over again, you know. But yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's just, you know, there were no there was the beginning of the internet back in 95. Back in 94, which I was just thinking about this yesterday. Because there's a Grateful Dead podcast that, if you guys haven't listened to, is absolutely fantastic. The good old Grateful Dead podcast. And they're talking about the different eras of where the culture out in California, particularly around the Bay, that the high-end, high-tech culture going all the way from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that, you know, was around Stanford and around, obviously, what turned into Apple, and how it kind of intersected with all the deadheads and all the people involved in the dead scene. But anyway, why I'm mentioning that is because they did start bringing up the exact cusp of when the first, really the first round of internet before the browsers, basically the Usenet years, which Kyle turned me on to, my roommate Kyle Cassidy. So I got turned on to the Usenet years in 91, but definitely 92, 93, and all running on Unix, all basically logging into these Unix servers at the campus. And in 94, on a very, very, very brief and extremely cheap trip to visit John in Mile End in Limehouse, hence the word Mile End in the title, I did visit one of the very, very first internet cafes. I don't think it was called an internet cafe because I forget what it was called, but basically it was a cafe with servers. And reason I'm bringing up the Dead podcast because they actually interviewed the guy who came up with the term finger when it came to Oh, thank you. When it came to finding out who was available at the moment on the server. So basically, yeah, I logged into one of the servers at Rowan. I'm meanwhile in London, and it's about, I don't know, you know, like 2 or 3 o'clock London time. And maybe a little bit later. And yeah, I lucked out. I basically did a search, or, you know, a finger to see who was around on the server at Rowan, and Kyle was on. And basically, yeah, I'll never forget it. It was like we're having a real-time conversation. It was a split screen, monochrome, you know, basically like, you know, if you ever go into Terminal, it's what it looked like. And I'm chatting away in my little part of the screen. It's something, you know, it's just so primitive and raw, you know, just these green monochrome colors, text coming up, you know, like, dude, I'm in London, you know, and Kyle's responding back. And this all was so amazing because you never did that before. We weren't surfing. We weren't chatting on a closed network. You know, there were closed networks back then of CompuServe and I think Prodigy, and basically you paid a certain subscription and you basically just pinged around and met and chatted with people all in one location. You know, they had their own little version of a supercomputer in 90 whatever, that was not the internet. This was the internet. Like, we were on the internet together, halfway around the world with no browser. There was no browser. You know, like, there was no browser. You pretty much like just dialed into a server somewhere, so looked around and see who was on, or else you used the Usenet groups, which I won't go off on a complete tangent on. Anyhow, yeah, so going back to 1995, so there was a hint of the internet around, and when I came back, or maybe just before I left, Mosaic, the browser had finally come to the computer lab up in Rowan. But yeah, this book was the last really big project that I worked on. It's all based on the summer months of 1995. Describing the view, fictionalized of a character from New Jersey, heading over to try to get some meaning from this socialist experiment called a kibbutz, being extremely cynical of that experience, but at the same time being very moved by it, but in unexpected ways. And in real life, this was the last hurrah of the socialist experiment over there. It was the last bit of optimism, you know, over there. There was still a pretty strong, believe it or not, liberal side to the demographic. There was some strong players from labor in the government, and and even some of the hawks at that time were finally ready to meet up and sign something to start the two-state process. And it was just this, you know, of course there were car bombs and bus bombs still going on. There was still a need from the ultra right on the Israeli side and the ultra military on both the extremist and not even so extreme side of several different Palestinian causes to just say screw that. Let's keep killing each other. That would be the best solution. But at that time in 95, there was really a sense of optimism, and people from all around the world would use the socialist experiment called a kibbutz as kind of a stopping gap, a sort of let's go there, save up some money, meet some friends, you know, party on our day off, and from there launch onto the rest of the trip. So from there, go down to Jordan or go down to Egypt or go even further, Maybe you've started in Turkey and then you went to a kibbutz and then you'd continue on someplace else. So there was an incredible, incredibly passionate travel scene thriving in 95. It was all pretty much steered by a lot of the Bible of the travel scene, the backpack scene back then was a Let's Go book. So you'd get like a Let's Go Israel or Let's Go Egypt or Let's Go Europe or the British version of Let's Go, you know, whose name escapes me right now, but I'm sure I'll think of it in a minute. But yeah, that was my last big hurrah in a way. I think I was still young at heart enough to really absorb the travel. There was a lot of randomness going on this trip, a lot of hitchhiking, a lot of stuff that... Well, a lot for me. I'm not normally a hitchhiker. But yeah, a lot of random stuff and a lot of really interesting coincidences. And yeah, a lot of really, really important friendships. And just, yeah, probably the most, it had the most impressions. And how can I say it? I was in an impressionable mode. I knew I was really hungry for something to write about. And I was at that point in my life where... I could really sort of both appreciate the weirdness that was going on at the same time store just a little bit away to try to write about it years later. And that's what I did. I kind of like about a year or two later started cranking out a first draft on an actual manual typewriter. I still have the original draft. Wonderful to look at that thing. And then I kind of ran out of time. I had to get a job, had to get fully employed again. Was living really below the poverty line at that time. And things just sped up to never finish it. I never got a chance to finish the book, never got a chance to do a proper rewrite. So it was literally those two things. Never actually finished the book, because there was a whole other section in my mind that essentially it was only like two-thirds written. There was a whole other section I wanted to write about to kind of tie it into why I called it Mile End. And then, of course, like any book, I would have loved to have worked with someone who could explain to me why I need to cut this and cut that and delete this and delete that and start over here and start over there and fine tune and rewrite that, you know, because, you know, people who are very, very happy with what they've written, including my friend Phil, who I met on that same kibbutz, who's a successfully published author now, got help on a second draft, you know, showed it to people and they got feedback. I think at that time, I just let it go. I just figured, well, I don't have time to finish it. And why would I show it around if it's not even finished? So yeah, it just kind of lapsed, didn't go anywhere for a couple of years. And then finally, at the dawn of the 21st century, around 2000 or 2001, self-publishing became a thing where there was a company based in Philly called Ex Libris, and they had a promotion where if you just sent them a manuscript, they would just publish your book on demand. And that's, of course, still very, very popular. A lot of people are still using Amazon now for that, where once you finish a manuscript, you can just, you can do it a lot better now. You can edit it, you can include your own photos, and you can get it printed essentially on demand. But you know, looking back, I still have some, there's still some good stuff to chew on. I think that, you know, that's a pretty good thing to be able to say, you know, if you've got a manuscript, whether it's a short story, whether it's a six-line poem, whether it's some autobiographical thing that's still not quite finished, but if you can reread it 3 months later, 3 years later, 30 years later, then obviously something is okay in that bit of writing. Something's not too horrible. Because normally if it's really bad, you don't even have the patience to reread it at all. Anyhow, that was my first attempt at combining some of my own literature in with the podcast. But yeah, I got lots to talk about. Hope you guys will join me for season three, episode two, where I'm going to be, I guess, jumping back into photography and hopefully bringing it all back home, back online. See ya.